Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. The number of women heading to prison keeps rising, but the programs to help them navigate life once they're back out have not. Reintegration has largely centered around men, even though women take different paths to prison and face different roadblocks when they're released. For example, more than half of women in prison were the primary caretakers for minor children before being sent away. And nearly half of all female inmates report being the victim of childhood sexual assaults, rates that are much higher for women than they are for men. They're also more likely to have addictions or be incarcerated for drug-related crimes. So what do we do about it? How do we build a better system to bring these women back into society? It's a really big question. And we're devoting the next hour to understanding why women end up in prison and how we're helping or hurting them once they get out. Joining us to start this conversation is Wanda Bertram, a communication strategist for the Prison Policy Initiative. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan research and advocacy group. Welcome to All Sides, Wanda.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
Before we talk about solutions, I want to give our listeners an understanding of who is in prison and the pathways that women take to get there. Because, as I said in the opening, they're different from men. So first off, about how many women are incarcerated here in the United States?
So our most recent calculations find that about 196,000 women are behind bars on any given day in prisons, in jails, and other types of confinement facilities. Now, that's just a fraction of the 1.9 million people who are incarcerated on any given day, most of whom are men, right? In Ohio, for instance, there's 45,000 people in prison, 3,500 women in prison. So it's a smaller number of women than of men, but it's still a number that's massive compared to what it used to be.
Yeah, and that is my second question. So when did research start to show that this trend towards more women being incarcerated? Because if you look at percentage increase decade over decade, it's wild.
Right. I mean, women's incarceration and men's incarceration both began to rise, you know, in the 60s and the 70s, when the war on drugs was declared and the era of mass incarceration that we're still living in was inaugurated. But in particular, what we saw over the last couple decades, since the 2000s, was that women's incarceration actually began to rise faster than men's. Now, that's a trend that's kind of slowed down over the last few years. But in Ohio, for example, you had women's incarceration rates rising at a rate that was higher than the rate at which men's incarceration was rising. And so what we attributed that to was, well, a couple things. First was, an intensification of the war on drugs. And then second was the introduction of broken windows policing, which, for those who don't know, it's a type of policing that holds that if you go hard after low-level crimes and low-level offenses and misdemeanors in underserved communities, that will make the community safer and bring down the rates of more serious crimes. Now, that theory has been pretty well debunked over the last few years, but in the process when it was popular, what it did was it netted a lot of really vulnerable people committing low-level offenses into the system, and that created a disproportionate rise in the incarceration of women. That drove women's prison populations up, and it contributed to what you were saying at the top, which was that more women than men are incarcerated for drug crimes.
And I also want to ask if you can break down the numbers by race. Is there a disparity between, say, white women and women of color heading to prison?
Absolutely. I mean, we do know that there's, you know, just like with the general prison population, Black women have a much higher incarceration rate than white women do. Although, you know, I have to say, over the last few years, as we've seen arrests increase for drug crimes and other things, actually white women's incarceration rates are rising a little bit faster than Black women's. What I attribute that to, conclusively proven, but I think a pretty compelling hypothesis for why that is that white women who were previously not going to be caught up in the system, a system that, you know, over decades has targeted Black people, were then, because of a broadening net of drug enforcement, began to be pulled into it. And that happened concurrently with the opioid crisis, which has devastated, you know, white, Black, Latino, all communities.
And one of the biggest differences between women who end up behind bars and men is that overwhelmingly the women in prison were the primary caregivers for minor children before they were locked up.
That's right. You mentioned a statistic about over half of women in prison being mothers of minor children. I think that, one of the things that's even more striking is that 39% of women in prison were the single parents of their children, living with their children at the time of their arrest. So that's, that is, that is hundreds of thousands of children who have been torn away from their single moms, because of incarceration.
It seems like almost when men go to prison, their partners care for the kids. But when women go to prison, their children are much more likely to end up in the foster care system.
That's right, and it really is devastating because we know also that people who are in prison, foster care is one of the pipelines that gets people there, right? And it's one of several adverse childhood experiences that we see among the state prison population. So in tearing women apart from their kids, it arguably contributes to this cycle, it just perpetuates incarceration down the line.
We're going to discuss this later in the program, but re-entry back into society can be challenging for anybody who's getting out of prison, especially someone who served a longer sentence. But the number of programs for women that are sort of tailored to these unique needs, more likely to be drug crimes, more likely to have histories of domestic violence, sexual abuse, more likely to have children in the system, it doesn't seem like our re-entry programs have caught up to these differences.
No, that you're absolutely right about that, and I think this is actually where conversations about reentry for women and conversations about reentry for men kind of converge because we really as a society no state is doing enough to provide the kinds of supportive services that people with these issues need, right? What we know is that for example, people who have serious drug addictions, people who have a mental illness, people who are homeless, these populations are often, they overlap, right? And formerly incarcerated people are more likely to be all three. And what we know is that what works to keep these folks stable and out of prison is long-term supportive housing, right? Permanent supportive housing that offers them the option of getting treatment on their own schedule, but doesn't force them to. We've seen programs like that work actually in Ohio. We've seen programs like that work in states across the country, but they're not being invested in enough. We also know that healthcare for formerly incarcerated people is extremely insufficient. About 25% of people on probation and parole have no health insurance. And this is that's one of those, what we call kind of low-hanging fruit, criminal justice reforms that states could tackle today, making sure that every person who's getting out of prison or getting out of jail, who is eligible for Medicaid is getting signed up. And that's particularly important in prisons because often in prison, when you go, if you were on Medicaid before, you get kicked off. And so just, simply, re-enrolling people in healthcare can help stabilize those first critical weeks and months of the recovery entry.
Especially if they are being treated medically for any kind of underlying mental health or physical conditions.
Absolutely. Many women in prison and many men are able to get support for drug and mental health problems while they're incarcerated. And it's tragic when they're not able to continue those same treatments after their release. It's that kind of continuum of care that I think states are really dropping the ball on.
What I find really fascinating is this rise, and I want to kind of dive into it a little bit deeper, is the rise in women who are going for drug crimes, and that women are more likely to be arrested and jailed for these crimes, and they're also more likely to struggle with addiction. And I find that difference fascinating, and I wonder if you have any theories or hypothesis about why.
I think that it, I mean, there's, it's a really good question, but I think it does have to do with selection, right? The women in prison and jail are more likely to be there for drug crimes. They're just more like they're, and I think we can say also they're less likely to be there for violent crimes. The statistically, men are more likely to commit violent crime, right? So when you look at this population, it's a lot of drug crimes are committed by people who have drug addictions. Right, that's just how it works, and I think that importantly, when you have a system like this that's pulling in people who are struggling with these problems, that's even more of an indication, that we need to end this war on drugs, right? Recently, in recent years, we've seen, of course, a terrible rise in overdose deaths, especially with fentanyl permeating the drug supply. And all too often, lawmakers' answers to this has been, we're going to ramp up punishment, right? We're gonna increase prison terms, and we're gonna double down on prosecution, and we're even gonna charge people who have been distributing these drugs with murder, right? And that, as much as it might give satisfaction, this idea that we're going to be punishing people who distribute dangerous substances, that does not stop the fentanyl crisis. It does not stop the public health crisis around drugs. What it does do is it nets vulnerable people, disproportionately women, into the system. So I think that these numbers are an indication that we need to do something different.
I'm going to make a sidetrack. This is if you want a really deep dive into the history of the war on drugs, there is a podcast literally called The War on Drugs. It's a 10-part series. It just came out a couple weeks months ago. It's not through NPR. It's not through WOSU. I'm not being paid to say it. It's a really excellent deep dive into the history and the genesis of the war on drugs.
Awesome. I should also say, the data that we have around drug arrests and women is pretty striking. What we found is that from the 80s through up through 2019, men's drug arrests rose 46%, women's drug arrests rose 216%.
Oh my
So,
goodness.
right. So it really is. This suite of policies that we have, making increasingly criminalizing. People for these often survival behaviors is disproportionately impacting women.
So, and one of the things I do want to talk about is even though women are not likely or not. Maybe likely isn't the word. They're less likely than men to commit violent crimes. What I found really fascinating is when women get arrested for violent crimes, a lot of times they're against a partner. And not all of the time, I'm not excusing it, but a lot, there is a decent chunk that have a history of calls for domestic violence issues. And that's just a fascinating, like, little sliver of data.
That's, yeah, I think I'm so glad that you brought that up because, we've been talking about drug crimes, but it's not the only, that doesn't, that's not the story of all women who are incarcerated. There's a lot of women who are incarcerated for crimes that are labeled as violent, right? And I think it's also important to talk about the fact that even though, we can try to distinguish between a quote unquote nonviolent offender and a quote unquote violent offender, there are lots of women who are in prison for crimes that involve self-defense, right? Crimes that may have been crimes of violence that may have been that they may have been pressured into by a partner, right? Also crimes that they may have been accessory to but didn't commit that happened to be violent, and so they still get saddled with a violent charge. These labels of violent and nonviolent are unfortunately to used to, I think, sort incarcerated people into those who are deserving of things like parole, clemency, to sort people who are in the pretrial system into those who are deserving of diversion programs or not deserving of diversion programs. And they really are categories that have a lot of they have a lot of gray area, and they have a lot of bleed. And so if any policymakers, lawmakers listening to this, we urge people, we urge lawmakers to not draw these really inappropriate and reductive distinctions between people because they often don't tell the whole story.
Are there places or programs across the country that you think are doing a really great or like a unique job in meeting these needs of women reentering?
That's a great question. One program that I want to shout out is called The New Way of Life, and it's run by a woman named Susan Burton out of Los Angeles. Now, we all have this concept of transitional housing and reentry housing, halfway houses for people who are coming out of incarceration. But there's a difference between a halfway house, which is basically just kind of a step down from prison, right? It's like a slightly more open air prison in the community. There's a difference between that and a place that you can go. With people who understand and relate to your experience, who can also provide wraparound services, and that's exactly what this organization, A New Way of Life, is doing. I think they're expanding right now, but to other states, but they're primarily in California, and they provide housing, they provide counseling, trauma support, believe, trying to get people into healthcare and housing and long-term things like that. And I think that, so many of the best programs for women reentering society are run by formerly incarcerated women themselves, and this is one of them. And there really need to be more grant programs and more resources for these amazing programs, because they're only serving a fraction of the women that they could be serving.
That was Wanda Bertram from the Prison Policy Initiative, a nonprofit, nonpartisan research and advocacy center. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're talking with a mother who recently left the prison system after 10 years behind bars. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking about the rising number of women in prison and whether our systems are set up to help them before, during, and after their incarcerations. Heather Jarvis was in prison for 10 years, and she recently completed a six-month reentry program called Elvis. She's now a criminal justice advocate and journalist and an Ohio State student majoring in social work. Welcome to All Sides, Heather.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Denise Robinson. She's the president and CEO of the Columbus-based Elvis, which contracts with the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections to provide residential treatment for inmates prior to their release. Welcome to All Sides, Denise.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Heather, I'm hoping you can start by just telling us a little bit about your personal story.
My personal story started when I was very young. My own mother was incarcerated, and I just followed in her footsteps. By the time I was 14, I was pregnant. I had a daughter. By the time I was 16, I entered the juvenile justice system. By the time I was 22, I got sentenced to 10 years in prison, and it stemmed from opiates. And just right whenever the opioid crisis was kicking off is when I got incarcerated. Sometimes I'd like to think that God spared me. And I went to prison, and I was very determined to just rehabilitate myself and do everything I could to become a better person. So I really took the opportunity to just grow and reflect and learn things that I didn't learn growing up.
Denise, trauma is a through line through many inmates' lives. How has that informed what you do at Elvis?
So I would say that most of our women come to us with trauma, and also their children have a lot of trauma. And so we've been able to adjust programming so that we're making sure and ensuring that we are providing the best research-based programs to women, and so that they're able to address it right on, head on, because we have to. In order to be well, they have to address the trauma.
And about how long do people stay at Elvis before they're released from the system?
So it's according on what status they are, but the average is about 3 to 6 months. And some of our clients do stay with us for a year. And it's according to their court orders or from the Federal Bureau of Prisons or the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections, according on that, but also it's according on what they have assessed that they need to complete before they exit our program.
I want to say quickly that we did invite the director of the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction to take part in this conversation, but she was unavailable. We also invited the warden of the Ohio Reformatory for Women, and she was also unavailable. So, Heather, I want to... You fit a lot of the, I don't want to call them stereotypes, but you fit sort of the stereotypical woman who ends up in prison, in particular because you were the caregiver to two children at the time of your incarceration.
That's correct.
And your youngest daughter was 5 months old.
Yes, and she never knew me. I mean, I did the best I could to get to know her while I was incarcerated, and I really went above and beyond. I would do funny things on video visits and send her packages with so much random stuff and glitter and drive everybody crazy at my house. And I tried, and I got out, and it was like, I don't know, you could tell she had been waiting on me.
And that was the same for you too, right? You waited on your mother for a long time.
Yes, I absolutely did.
And I have to say, I did a deep dive into your website, and I read a lot of your writing, and you're incredibly talented, I would just say.
Thank you.
There were several times where I was like, oh, that's a nice way of putting it. Just like the literal words that you strung together were creative.
Thank you.
Particularly like the gut punch to me, you know, and I think it would be a gut punch to a lot of parents, is when you talk about like, you don't know how she likes her eggs, or like when she learned to walk and talk, or watch her slurp spaghetti, or like just become the tiny human person that she is.
Yeah, and I still haven't fully got to step into her life in that aspect, just because I did choose to start over in Columbus instead of going home. But I have got to experience some things with her. I got to brush her hair. I got to eat talkies with her. And I just am very grateful that she is just very open to our relationship, and she'll be up here on the last day of school.
How important was, or how impactful was your time at Alvis prior to reentry into the community?
My time at Alvis was very challenging just because of the restrictions that are put on like movement and things you can do within the community. Like you can work and go to church, but as far as other community ties and things, and just like simple things, like I couldn't go to Scene 75 with my daughter for her birthday because it was against the rules. I'm from out of state, so I couldn't get a home pass, so I couldn't be with my family. I couldn't get day passes. I wasn't allowed to go to restaurants with my family. I wasn't allowed to do anything with them, and that was very hard for me.
Denise, what is the rationale behind a lot of that, or how does that work in the program?
Yeah, because of Heather's status, those are the rules that are given to us, and we are not permitted to allow them to do those types of things until they leave, actually. So there's just different statuses that come through our programs that we're just unable to grant that, because if you're a transitional control client, you're still considered an inmate, and you are just completing the last months of your stay. That would typically be done in prison, but you're doing it in the community, so you can get that job, so we can start on that reunification piece, so we can start on all of those things to reintegrate back. But it's because of her status. And let me say this, though. I am so proud of Heather. I mean, I'm just really proud. I've never met you in person, but I really am proud of the accomplishments that you've made.
Thank you.
So you're not a traditional halfway house, or what we might conceive of, or are you? Like, I guess it's like I'm trying to figure out where in the rehab process your Alvis fits in.
So we are a treatment facility. So it's all based on treatment. And so, getting a job is one of those things, but everyone that comes through our programs are assessed. And they're assessed using the Ohio risk assessment system that was developed by the University of Cincinnati. And actually that assessment tool is used throughout the criminal justice system. So if you go to jail, you're assessed there. When you go to prison, when you come to us, and then when you go to probation and parole, you're assessed it all the way through. The assessment is to determine your needs while you're with us, and also your risk to reoffend.
Heather, I want to ask you about some different steps in your own personal process and where you think perhaps things could be better. if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you end up in prison, your crime was considered violent, although you yourself were not violent.
Correct.
Can you kind of explain what happened there and how you ended up with a longer sentence than you would for like a drug crime?
Well, my crime was drug related. It was a drug deal that went wrong. And I was very complicit, and I do accept full responsibility for that. However, I was not the person that committed a violent crime, and now I will forever be labeled a violent offender. I cannot get away from it. It's just, it's very hard whenever you're incarcerated. There are certain programs you can't do because you're violent. There's just, it's very limiting. And then even out here, I had a job interview, and I was so excited for it. They let me go all the way to orientation, and then in orientation, somehow they've decided that my crime was violent, and so I got, like, basically kicked out of orientation simply because my crime was violent.
And without getting it too deep into the specifics, I mean, you share what you're comfortable sharing. My understanding is that somebody else shot somebody else,
mm-hmm.
and you happened to be there, essentially.
Yes.
So you were not the person doing the shooting. You were not the person being shot.
Right. I was just kind of there. It was just a drug deal that just went wrong and turned into like a robbery situation. And the person I was with was not used to that, being on that end of the situation, because we were in a very fast lifestyle at the time. And it just went wrong. And it ended up that my friend of basically years, my whole childhood, ended up passing away. And then I was held responsible because of it. And I do agree that my decisions were there, but I don't agree that I deserve to be labeled violent for the rest of my life just for being complicit. But the system is what it is.
Denise, that's a really complicated and difficult system. And I'm not going to ask you to, you know, opine on the judicial system as a whole and how we create sentencing. But do you see situations like Heather's come through Alvis?
Yes, absolutely. We do see folks that had no direct, culpability in the crime and do end up spending a lot of time in prison. It's not, it's not hugely, but it is a lot. There are folks that have spent many years incarcerated where I always lean on the side of treatment, that I feel like if they were getting treatment, they would be better.
Yeah. One of the stunning statistics in preparation for this episode is just the number of women in prison who report being victims of sexual assault, victims of domestic violence, victims of childhood sexual assaults. It seems like those traumas, particularly in early childhood, can really set you on a path that ends up being destructive.
Yeah, absolutely. From my perspective, being in there and being around all the women in there, the trauma is very dominant. And on any given conversation, you're going to end up talking to someone about what they've been through. You might be in a group with someone and be completely shocked that they have been through everything that they've been through. And hurt people hurt people. And so I think that's how things just come into play and how women get in there. But some of the best women that I've ever met are incarcerated and for violent offenses and that stem from, like you said, like sexual trauma situations, protecting themselves situations. And some of them are never going to get a chance to get out just for protecting themselves.
Denise, how many, if you could put a number on it, about how many women going through Alvis are mothers or were primary caregivers of minor children prior to their incarcerations?
Probably about 60% that come through Alvis are mothers.
And so, yeah, I was going to ask, how do you guys help maybe start to reform those familial bonds?
Yeah, so I was thinking as you were talking with Heather that about 10 years ago, I saw three generations of a family at Alvis. It was a mom, a grandmother, and the mom's child. And it was really, really hard for us to say, okay, what are we doing? What are we going to do with these kids? What are we going to do with these moms? We have to treat these moms. And so we developed a program, a parenting program, It's parenting classes, parenting coaching, educational support and prevention services for the children. And we also have clinical counseling for the children, structured activities for the mothers and children. And then that helps them get to know one another and helps to develop routines. Now, there's separate family and children's programs at ALVIS. Under our Amethyst program, which is an ALVIS recovery program, our kids actually live with their moms as they're getting treatment and the kids are being treated at the same time. In Heather's case, the program that she was in, we do not allow the children to live with their parents then with them at the time. But there is parenting classes, and I think she did take advantage of those.
Yes, I did.
You know, it sounds like, Denise and, you know, Heather, I'd like to get your take on this too. Do you think that Ohio could benefit from more programs like yours, more wraparound services, more care and counseling for women in particular as they leave the prison system?
Oh, for me, I would always say that there more is better. More is always better.
Are you ever at capacity? Like you just can't take any more people?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we have waiting lists, but we also have just built and new programs. And so we do have more space now. And because a lot of folks, a lot of different agencies do not work with the whole family like we do. In Heather's case, like I said before, she was in a different program. But when you would have those wraparound services for the families, it's much more beneficial. And you can look at any of the research, it'll tell you that the client that is the former offender will be more successful if you're working with the total family.
Yeah, I, in my experience, the programs that come into the prison and follow you out are the ones that are most beneficial. I was blessed to be part of the Embark program and then a part of Arch Reentry. And I started them in prison and they have followed me out and they do offer wraparound services. The sad part is that it's only to a certain number of individuals that come out. Embark is an amazing program, but it only serves 18 women a year.
18?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh my goodness.
And then Arch is amazing. And they have truly been my rock since I got out and they offer everything. They have Cafe Overlook down at the courthouse there. I just could get on and on about what Arch has done to help me. And it's just, there's definitely a hunger for programming and definitely a need. There's just not a capacity for it right now.
Were these the programs that connected you with the author of Orange is the New Black?
So Piper, I met Piper when I was in prison. It was just a writing program. She kind of kept it secret. Nobody really knew it was hers. It was like, write a story and submit it. And then if you get in, you find out it's Piper's group. So it's kind of, I don't know, I met her and she learned, that's where I did find my love of writing. And like when my dad passed away, that is what I used, was writing. But it is, it's programs like that. Like that's what I started in there. It's the things that you start in there that can grow and build. And that's what follows you out the gate. Not, it shouldn't be your crime.
So you ended up basically, she was your writing coach for a long time.
Well, it was like it was a small group of us, probably eight. And I love all of them equally. And I still can hear one of my teachers, her little sidekick, Chris. I can still hear him in my head when I'm writing, like, say more about that.
So, yeah. Tell me more.
Yes, that's exactly it.
No, I love that. But yeah, those are, you know, you're talking about a group of eight, a group of 18, a group of 100 or so. Like, these are very small piecemeal programs.
Yes. And currently there's I went and testified at the State House for, there's currently a Senate Bill 198. And they, part of the piece that I'm advocating for is a language change that would allow outside organizations to come in and facilitate job readiness and resume building and things, and would take the burden off of ODRC.
Remind us of the bill number again.
Senate Bill 198.
And I wanted to ask, would you be willing to share your website if people want to go and read your writing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You can go to heathercjarvis.com and under my portfolio, all my work's there. And then I'm trying to build a social media presence. It's not working, so help me out.
Maybe we can help you out with that. Denise, if we are interested in learning more about what ALVIS does, how do we get in contact with you?
Yes, it's ALVIS 180.org.
Well, Denise Robinson, the president and CEO of Columbus-based Alvis Incorporated, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
And Heather Jarvis, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're talking with a legal expert on how sentencing laws and the war on drugs play a role in incarceration. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking about the rising number of women in prison this hour. And now we want to focus on the legal system itself, our laws and our mandatory sentencing rules, and how they impact female offenders in particular. Joining us is Douglas Berman, Executive Director of the Drug Enforcement and Policy Center at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. Welcome to All Sides, Douglas.
Thank you so much, Anna.
From your perspective, how do Ohio's sentencing laws contribute to the number of people in prison?
Well, certainly our sentencing laws at the state level, at the federal level, define and shape how judges respond to convictions as they're brought to them. And usually it's through plea deals, and sentencing always ends up shaping how a plea deal will go forward. And so if there's, whether it's a mandatory minimum term, whether it's just a severe felony conviction that would go with a particular offense that then leads to a negotiation that will include a jail time, a prison period, all of that ends up cashing out in more and more people historically over the last 40 or 50 years, and in Ohio in particular, being subject to at least the possibility of incarceration. And then when judges have to impose sentences, whether that's shaped by the plea deal, whether that's shaped by the conviction, these laws define what their options are, and often incarceration appears as not just a viable, but the appropriate option for an awful lot of offenders.
And sometimes there are mandatory minimums. So legally, the judge's hands are tied in terms of what they can sentence someone to.
That's exactly right. And that's what the mandatory part of mandatory minimums provide. And the minimum is almost always a prison term. And again, different states and the federal system have different structures for how that functions. But you were talking earlier about the war on drugs and the way in which drug offenses, which are women are disproportionately involved in and sent to prison for, they often focus on just the amount of the drugs. And so that ends up driving an awful lot of incarceration options or mandates, because the weight of the drugs can be often determined by other people involved in the conspiracy. But if even a low-level offender gets caught with a certain amount of drugs, they may at least be threatened with a certain amount of prison time.
And there's this conflict, or perhaps it's more of a delicate dance, right, between wanting to deter criminal behavior and yet not have laws so severe that the efforts at rehabilitation are not productive.
That's exactly right. In fact, that's what's often driven legislators, others, to advocate for mandatory minimums. The thought is, and we think about it in terms of the opiate epidemic going on right now, well, other things haven't worked. How do we get people to stop doing this? How do we get people to stop being involved in trafficking drugs or other offenses? Well, let's say you have to get a certain amount of prison time if you're involved, even if at a low level, that'll convince folks, not to get involved. And the research evidence suggests that there can be a little deterrent effect from a certain degree of certainty in punishment. But what we see over time is if those punishments aren't imposed swiftly, especially if those punishments aren't known to people involved, it can't have the same kind of deterrent effect and can't help us avoid people going down criminal paths as potentially other approaches to dealing with criminogenic conditions.
And there can also be a disparity in sentencing. I know we talked about it a little bit throughout this program, but that people of color are much more likely to receive maximum sentences.
Yeah, the data is very disconcerting, and there's been, you know, a sort of focus on it at kind of every level, every jurisdiction, every nature of drug, every other kind of crime. We end up seeing a bunch of racial disparities in the application. Now, there's a huge debate over kind of where in our system that ends up getting reflected. There's no doubt that persons with socioeconomic disadvantage are disproportionately involved in crime and disproportionately, you know, sent to prison. Is that what explains these racial disparities? And there are always efforts to control for those kinds of factors. One of the things that I think has been particularly pernicious in the war on drugs over time, and it sometimes goes unseen but is so important, is the way in which criminal history can stack up. So if there's a very low-level drug offense, and there may be a series of these where a non-prison sentence is given, and we think, okay, that's the right way to approach these issues, but still the criminal history is stacking up so that there's a mandatory minimum that the third offense necessarily creates, or, you know, some other offending produces. And so that's the way in which heavily policed communities, heavily subject to being brought into the criminal justice system, even at the lowest level, can then down the line produce some of these disparities that we see in all the data.
So how would you compare Ohio's sentencing laws to maybe surrounding states in the Midwest or the country more generally?
That's a great question, and one that has lots of nuances to it. I think Ohio has tried hard, and we've had a series of reforms over the last 40 years that have been doing two things that I think are very wise. Try to use prison as a relative last resort. And we've had a number of different reforms, largely driven by prison overcrowding, that has tried to encourage judges to not use prison except when it seems absolutely necessary. But at the same time, we've got sufficiently severe laws in place that when judges are given discretion, they often are going to be inclined to kind of err on the side of, well, this person seems risky, I'll send them to prison. And one of the factors that a number of scholars have highlighted is the degree to which that individual judge sitting in that county court looking at this risky offender, in some respects, it's not just easier, but feels more appropriate. Send that person to state prison if I've got discretion, then keep him in the community. And that's been one of the things that Ohio's reformed to try to encourage more judges to keep folks in the community. Other states, likewise, are always sort of struggling with this balance. I can say that almost every state is better in some respects than the federal system. The federal system has some of the most severe mandatory minimums, has some of the longest prison terms, even for relatively low-level offending, though that's often driven by the sense that prosecutors, federal prosecutors, won't bring people into the federal system unless they think the person is a real danger or risk. Doesn't always work out that way. But again, the dynamics of sentencing in the state level, companion states and the like, are very dynamic, but always in flux as well.
Yeah. In the last couple of years, what I've found fascinating in following the state house here in Ohio in particular is that it's been a bipartisan effort at, you know, barriers to reentry, expungements, and closing of criminal records. Like, there's been a real push from conservatives, traditionally those like war on drugs, tough on crime individuals that are having sort of a change of heart.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of factors that have played into that, but probably most significant has been the realization that the sort of increase in prison populations, the tough on crime era, hasn't eliminated the reality that 98% of folks sent to prison are going to get out at some point. And if you don't help prepare folks while they're in prison for effective reentry, if you create all these barriers once people get out, and there still are so many of them, you're just going to keep having very high recidivism rates. Ohio has been better than most other states with respect to recidivism rates. So again, it's an example of where I think we've done a good job, but there's still always more work to do. Criminal records reform is another thing that our center has been working a lot on, that the state house also, like you say, has been very bipartisan. And I think that's where, whatever other people think about the right way to respond to a crime, everybody understands that if we don't respond to an offender coming out of prison with giving them the best possible path towards a more productive life, we're just going to be back in the same situation again, and we're going to have community harms. And so that, I think, is where I'm always encouraged in this time of divided politics, that there's a lot of consensus to be found here on goals. The means can often be highly debated and uncertain. And that's, again, why I think academic centers and others doing research here is so important, and has also been contributing to developing best practices that across the political aisle folks are inclined to subscribe to.
We're talking a lot about prison and incarceration reform, but I do want to talk about bail, because a lot of people who end up in jail, so awaiting trial for a crime, you're not usually sent to prison. You're in jail until you've been convicted. But we find over and over again that the reason people are there is because they can't make bail. And this is not for, say, like somebody who's accused of murder, because a lot of times they're not even getting the option of bail. I'm talking about like low-level drug offenses, and they're spending 4 months, 6 months, 8 months, like a year in jail.
Yeah, so the historic approach to bail was we put a price tag, in a sense, on your freedom. And even though you haven't been convicted yet, even though you're just accused of a crime, if you can't meet this particular price tag, we're going to keep you incarcerated until it's time for your trial or some other resolution of your case. And a number of advocates have said that doesn't seem right in terms of fairness. That also seems incredibly counterproductive in terms of public safety, because when somebody's in jail, even for a very short period of time, they may lose their job, they may lose housing, they may lose a lot of the important factors that can contribute to them being law-abiding. And so, gee, we need to rethink this. At the same time, and we've had this back and forth here in Ohio, if we completely eliminate cash bail, do we trust judges? Can we make sensible judgments about riskiness? Because, again, as you mentioned, you know, for very serious crimes, our instinct is, well, that person's risky. They need to be held even while they're awaiting disposition of their case. And so figuring out what the right balance is there, figuring out whether eliminating cash bail entirely or having it available sometimes has been something that's been a big, robust debate here in Ohio. My sense of the literature is the states that have effectively eliminated cash bail and used a range of other mechanisms to keep the public safe have had good returns on that approach, but it's challenging and it requires continued work. And of course, every case is different, and it means helping judges understand, you know, kind of who are the risky individuals. And ultimately, you know, I think there's a understandable sense that economics alone shouldn't drive this, but economics correlates with so many other factors that has been part of our historical approach to bail.
There's also just a cost associated with it to taxpayers.
Absolutely. And again, that's where incarceration more generally, when you talked earlier about sort of bipartisan affinity for reform, it really has been driven historically by prison overcrowding and the price tag. Hey, you want a new prison for more people? That's going to cost so much. We got to raise taxes. And that's the moment, you know, when the, in a sense, the cost comes due, the bill comes due for a lock them all up approach. And that's what's often driven, again, folks on both sides of the aisle to say, all right, are there more cost-effective ways to keep our community safe and also, you know, in many respects, treat individual offenders, people accused of crimes, people even convicted of crimes in a better way, so we encourage them to get back to being productive citizens?
Yeah, one of the arguments for bail reform that I've always found fascinating is this idea that it may cause people who could have been found innocent to plea, because the plea is going to get them out way faster than waiting for trial.
Yeah, there's absolutely no doubt that there is this pressure that once somebody is incarcerated to just get this over with, right? And jail has done that. And in fact, especially like you mentioned, for lower level offenses, you may be only looking at 6 months, a year, you know, a relatively short term, even after you're convicted. And so it creates this pressure, even if somebody wants to assert their innocence, to just reach the sense, hey, it's easier for me to get home to my family, get on with my life if I plead guilty. And then this again gets to the issue I mentioned about criminal history, right? Once you've done that, you may not realize that if you get in trouble again, now it can be a doubling, a tripling of the sentence you're facing simply because you pled guilty to something that you believed you had a viable argument to dispute if you went to trial. And so that's another reason why a move away from cash bail, and even how this interacts with some conversations people are having about reforming our plea bargaining system. That, you know, that's itself what aggravates this, is maybe prosecutors, even judges, are comfortable sending people to jail while they await disposition, hoping then that creates a pressure to plea and gets the case moved along rather than have a big, long, protracted fight in court.
This is going to be a bit of a difficult question.
Oh, my favorite kind.
I sometimes wonder if electing our judges and electing our prosecutors creates the incentive for longer sentences.
That's something that's been widely studied in a variety of settings, and the evidence is actually a little more mixed than we might think. What the evidence seems to suggest is right before an election's coming up, so maybe the 3 months when people are really paying attention to who's the judge, who's the prosecutor, the reality of an electoral system may be encouraging them to be, and I think they'd likely say, risk averse, right? I'm not going to just put an offender out there if I really think they're risky. I don't want to do that anyway, but I'm especially not going to do that when I know there could be a campaign ad against me. The challenge is, and I think it's the challenge that this research highlights, is even unelected prosecutors, even unelected judges have a bunch of institutional pressures toward toughness that itself may be as significant, maybe sometimes even more significant than the electoral process. And in fact, this has been a big part of kind of the recent reform movement, is to try to elect more reform-minded prosecutors. And so we've seen that to some degree here in Ohio. We've seen it in major cities across the country, where the electoral realities for district attorneys is not just a break against possible tough on crime approaches, but that folks are campaigning, I'm going to take a different approach. I'm not going to prosecute certain low level offenses. I'm going to have a conviction integrity unit or a sentence integrity unit. And it gives the people a chance to have a say in all of that. How that all cashes out long term is something we're still watching, but it's where I do think your instinct is right. The politics matter, but how exactly it matters is still being figured through.
That was Douglas Berman, Executive Director of the Drug Enforcement and Policy Center at Ohio State's Moritz College of Law. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Anna, for having me.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.